This is the Bat Pod.
Grab your bat microphone, it's time to start the show. Like a court of owls, the mystery is starting to grow. Let there be no debate, it's about to begin. Keen like Bruce Wayne, quick like Tim Drake, fierce like Damien. Grab your headphones, listen up, you know you love it. Drop the facade. Like the Dark Knight Detective, they've got some perspective. They're a pure crime-fighting collective. It's the Bat Pod.
Welcome to the Bat Pod. My name is Bill Beer. And joining me tonight from the Secret Wars and Beyond podcast, Sean Ross.
How's it going, man?
Good. How you doing?
I'm good. I am super, super excited to be here tonight, and I'm super excited to talk about this issue. Like, this is a holy grail, man. This is something I was like, oh, I'm never going to get to talk about this. So when this all worked out, I was just jumping for joy. So I'm thanking you preemptively.
Oh, yeah. No problem. No problem at all. Yes. It's a book that we haven't talked about here on the Bat Pod. We've been getting into more back issues lately. We did back issues during the coronavirus, shut in, when DC Comics weren't releasing their books. So we've kept up with back issues. But whenever I have guests on, I like to talk about back issues, and I usually let them pick something. And you had mentioned several different issues, but this was the one that really was like, yep, we need to do Batman 400.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go ahead and give me your experience. Not actually with the story, but with Batman 400. How did you first experience it?
So I was buying comics off the racks at this point. I started collecting in like late 82, early 83 when I was really young. And it was G.I. Joe. G.I. Joe was my gateway drug. It was, a kid on the playground like, hey, you want to try G.I. Joe issue 10? First one's free. and I was hooked for life. And so I bought those issues and that's really the book I was collecting. And then I got sick one day. I was, getting a fever or something. And I was at the grocery store with my mom, and I saw a comic book rack. And she took me home, and then she's like, oh, I'm going to run back to the store and get you some stuff because you're clearly not feeling well. And I was like, will you grab me some comic books? And she's like, sure, what do you want? And I was like, whatever. And so she saw Batman. And so, she had a memory of the Batman 66 show. So she's like, okay, that's something I recognize. And she bought me Batman. It was like 382. It was in the 300s. And brought it home, and I was hooked, and I love that run. It's Doug Monch, Tom Mandrake, and Gene Colan. They're kind of switching off and on art, and I was in. And so I was at the whims of the spinner rack. So I was buying Batman whenever I could, and that tended to be a book that showed up somewhat regularly, even though sales of Batman weren't great at the time. And so I was just collecting the book normally when Batman 400 came out, and I saw it, and I saw the cover, the Sienkiewicz cover, which I'm sure we'll talk about. Which is, got to be one of the 10 greatest Batman covers of all time. And even though it was a dollar, which was like, that was a pretty big dent back then for a kid who was, looking for change in the sofa cushions in order to buy his comics, I still was like, oh, this is too good. I've got to get this. And I bought it and I loved it. And we'll talk about why, especially to a kid, it would be appealing because it's such a jam band of a book. But I had no idea of its greater importance in the sort of history of the DC universe until way, 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 way later. So yeah, man, I bought this off the rack. I'm actually looking at the copy I bought back in 1985 or 86. So it's pretty cool to still have this thing because it's, 24, 25 years old at this point.
Yeah, nice, nice.
How about you?
My first experience, this was right around the time where I was in high school, and before driving, I would go to my grandparents on weekends, and sometimes we didn't have a comic shop in our town then, but we would go to this bookstore / video store / comic shop. It was called Wonder Book and Video, and we'd go to the store, and she'd be like, oh, pick out a couple comics. And during this time, Batman was something that I went to, and it was always the covers, because I never knew when what came out or anything like that. This was actually the first issue that I picked up I picked up every issue from this point. So 400 was the beginning of every issue. I have the last, 40 issues or so previous to this are picked in, I don't know, 10 to 15 different ones that I have, but 400 is the area where I started picking it up all the time because I was able to drive at this point. Mm-hmm. And then I could go get the books myself and didn't have to depend on somebody else.
Yeah, driving is the great equalizer for comic collectors. I think all of us have that. Like, all of us have the stories of the lengths we went to get to bookstores or comic book stores or wherever to get comics when we were young. And then there's that moment when you can drive when you're like, oh, there's a store 45 miles away from me, but I can go to it. And you discover back issues and all that stuff. And yeah, that's cool. I can't believe you started with like basically this book. I mean, that's a talk about a jumping on point. Like, that's amazing. This is such a seminal book. And to come in at this point, especially with all the changes that are coming, is just awesome.
Yeah, like it was just dumb luck because I remember seeing Crisis of Infinite Earths, but I didn't. I picked up an issue like in the middle and I was like, I have no idea what's going on. So I didn't know that there was this big changeover in anything. It was different when there's no internet, no nothing, no comic shop. So the people at the store, they knew nothing about what came out or what was in the books or recommend, hey, you should get this, because they had no idea.
I had the same experience with Crisis, man. My first issue of Crisis was issue 5, you know, which is that split cover with all the different characters from the different Earths on it. And I collected Batman for a long time and Detective and Teen Titans. There were kind of select DC books I liked, but to me at that age, DC was the old like stodgy company, right? Like if you read a Superman or Wonder Woman issue or even Flash, and I have some of those Flash issues, but if you read issues from that time, they feel like they could have come out in 1950 or 60 or 70. Like they're just these little, I don't know, they were so outdated relative to what else was happening. Even in their own company, right? Like on the stands, you had pre-Crisis Superman, which, I mean, felt like the oldest book on the shelves, right next to Alan Moore and, you know, Stephen Bissett's Swamp Thing, which felt like the most modern thing ever. And so I wasn't a huge DC fan, but I liked enough books that when I bought Crisis, I could kind of figure it out. But I had no idea. I had no idea about the repercussions of it. I didn't understand the seriousness of it. Like when Flash dies, I didn't understand that was the end of the Silver Age. Like, I didn't understand he had started the Silver Age. I didn't know any of that. So this issue for me was just a fun, like, oh, cool, all hands on deck, Batman versus everybody. This is great. I didn't realize the importance of the last page until I was much later, you know, much older.
Yes.
The Batpod is a spoiler podcast. Please read the comics we're reviewing so you can enjoy the show. We are a proud member of the Nerdy Legion Podcast Network.
When we discuss what we're going to do, there are so many creators on this book. If we gloss over some of these creators, it's just because there are so many and we didn't want to spend a lot of time on all the different, just reading off all the different creators. So this book is Batman 400 from October 1986. Your writer is Doug Munch. And in this issue, a mysterious benefactor arranges a massive breakout at both Arkham Asylum and Gotham State Penitentiary. Uniting both prisoners and patients, he arms them with their uniforms and weapons, giving them special instructions. Meanwhile, Batman finds a note taped to his Batcomputer that reads, "Know your foes." The mysterious benefactor revealed to be Ra's al Ghul enters the Batcave to tell Batman what he has done. He offers his service and permanently eliminated Batman's rogues should he agree to join his crusade. Batman, of course, refuses. Batman soon discovers that the villains have kidnapped people with connections to the Batman. Alfred Pennyworth, Harvey Bullock, Julia Pennyworth, and Vicki Vale. The Joker and the Penguin with a helicopter lower a giant steel net, turning the GCPD into a prison. The Joker forces Commissioner Gordon to contact Batman and tells him that he has 3 hours to rescue them or else all the hostages will die. Batman and Robin find assistance from Catwoman and Talia al Ghul. They split into 2 teams. Robin and Talia go after the group of villains at the GCPD, while Batman and Catwoman confront the criminals who have kidnapped Batman's allies. After successfully rescuing their allies, Batman defeats the Joker and regains control of Gotham City Police Department. The heroes then travel together to Ra's base of operations. They track him down to an old decrepit windmill where Ra's has hidden a location of one of his Lazarus pits. For the first time ever, Ra's immerses himself in the pit while still alive and soon emerges, now 10 times as strong as a normal human. Batman and his allies approach the windmill and use explosives to blast a hole in the windmill, providing them a quick entrance. Batman and Ra's face off, and he flips Ra's over his head, and Ra's lands for the second time in the Lazarus Pit. The explosives have greatly weakened the structure of the windmill, so Batman and the others race out of there, just as the windmill collapses with Ra's and assume that he is dead. Afterwards, Batman's allies gather together in the Batcave to celebrate Batman's anniversary of first putting on the cowl, but Batman refuses to join them, knowing that there are many of Gotham's most dangerous villains still at large, and it is not time for a celebration. So, as we talked about this book, the first thing that I did back then is when I went into a comic shop, you know, I would finger through it. See the cover. Cover looks interesting. I'd finger through it. And the one thing I do remember, one of the first things I finger through is I see this page with all these villains on it where they where Arkham Asylum and Gotham Prison are blown apart. The villains escape, and their uniforms is hanging in that forest. That's the first scene I see, and it's like, oh my goodness, this has all the villains in it. Every villain you could think of. And that really nailed it home for me as far as picking this book up.
Yeah, there's no holding back once you get to that scene. And the Steve Lytle draws that, and the scene of them getting to the part in the forest where their uniforms are located, there's this big shot of the Joker's face, and he's like, there they are, just as he promised. And the way they're hanging is so ominous because, one, it looks like they're dead, right? It looks like they're sort of hanging in death, which is kind of interesting considering what Ra's plan is. But then it's also overwhelming because you're like, well, there's no way. Any one of these villains is a three-issue arc, you know, a three-issue fight for Batman. And now they're all together. There's no way he's going to be able to stop this, which is the whole point of this book. And they pick the right guy. I mean, you have Steve Lytle drawing the costumes hanging, and then you cut to a section drawn by George Perez. And if you're going to have a group shot drawn, Perez is your man, right? Like, there's one better in the history of comics. And so I love that he got that particular section because it really drives home the overwhelming nature of the crowd. It's awesome. And I could see, if I were a kid seeing this book on the racks, I mean, I picked it up too, but I could see seeing it and being like, oh yeah, I'm in. It's everybody, I'm in. Because it's awesome. It's just, you never see this.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. The other thing that I notice is, first off, the one thing that I mentioned is this whole book is done in chapters. And every artist has their own chapters. It may be 2 pages, it may be 3 pages or more. And the one thing that I really liked when you go from, you know, Steve Lytle to George Perez to Paris Collins, the depiction of the villains and how they wear the costume, Mr. Freeze, for instance, the George Perez, you know, Mr. Freeze costume, I don't know if you noticed, but hanging up in the woods, it's Mr. Freeze, you know, costume where he has the fishbowl on his head.
Mm-hmm.
And then you switch to George Perez, and it's a more sophisticated looking Mr. Freeze costume. Did you happen to notice that?
Oh, yeah. I noticed there's a number of subtle changes because no one draws like Perez, right? And he draws costumes better than anybody. It's why there are costumes that he has designed, like Jack of Hearts, that look great when he draws them, that look terrible when anybody else draws them. Yeah, and the Mr. Freeze costume in particular is much – the helmet is more modernized, and it looks really cool, and it looks the way he'll look in a lot of later appearances.
Do you think the idea of this book was to – you know, it's the last book pre-crisis. Do you think the object was to kind of change from one, you know, pre-crisis to post-crisis as far as the art goes? Or do you think it's just a mixture of different artists and their interpretation?
That's a really good question. That's a really good question because it would make sense if they're trying to show the sort of passing of the torch from pre-crisis to post-crisis, though I don't think they have an idea yet of what, you know, quote unquote post-crisis is going to look like. They're building the ship as they're flying it, which results in some really cool stories. But I do think there is a choice in this book to acknowledge the current top artists. I mean, they have Byrne, Perez, even some really young up-and-comers like Art Adams, Brian Ballin, and Steve Rude. And then you've got, you know, Joe freaking Kubert. Like, you know, they're definitely, it's an homage to all of the great artists throughout comic history with a bit more of a tip of the cap to the current greats. And I do think it's just artistic license. I don't know that they are trying to position, like, the Mr. Freeze helmet, I think, is just an artistic choice.
Yeah,
I don't know
so.
That it's necessarily an acknowledgement of, hey, these things are changing. But I do think the way they position the artists definitely is purposeful because you get some really interesting follow-ups. Like you get Sienkiewicz followed by Art Adams. And so they put two of their more progressive artists right next to each other. But those guys, interestingly enough, follow, you know, Paris Collins, who is, you know, basically from the Steve Ditko school. So they, I think there was a conscious choice. I don't think it was willy-nilly. I think they gave the artist who best represented what was happening in the scene, they gave them that scene, which was brilliant. But I also think the way the art's positioned in the book is also a bit of a progression because it ultimately culminates in Brian Bolland, who really stylistically is very post-crisis, right? Like he's probably one of the three best cover artists of all time. And most of his work is coming post-crisis, though he has some pre. So I think it's a great question, man. I definitely think the art is doing more than just depicting the story in this book. I think there's a lot happening on a meta level too.
Yeah, absolutely. I would have to agree with that. Like, for instance, they have the script and they have it all into chapters and deciding who's going to draw what, you know, the editors and that sort of thing. Can you imagine anybody else drawing Bill Sienkiewicz's part in that? Because that was totally incredible, especially that scene in the Batcave with Roz, and that's where you get Roz coming in and said, yeah, it was me, I freed all your foes, I'm willing to kill them for you, you go ahead and follow me. And of course that isn't going to happen, but the imagery in there is awesome, especially there's that one panel where you see Batman's fierce face and you got the Joker, Penguin, Riddler, Scarecrow, Two-Face. Can you imagine anybody drawing those panels?
I can't imagine it anybody doing it better. So it's what's funny about it is they were smart, really smart to pick Sienkiewicz for this moment because it's just talking heads. There's no action in this. It's just Roz comes to the Batcave, makes his offer, and they go back and forth a little bit and Roz leaves. Like it could be a very boring, you know, intersectional, you know, chapter if anybody else is drawing it. It's just talking heads, right? But Sienkiewicz, my God. I mean, the man's talent is undeniable. But this is maybe with the exception of New Mutants 18, that first Demon Bear issue, this might be my favorite Sienkiewicz art of all time. And part of it is that montage of bat villains, which is amazing. And then also it's just the like the shadowy cape kind of creeping towards Roz.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so and metaphorically it's so good, right? Because it's the offer Roz makes. He's like, hey, I freed everybody. You can't win this. You've just spent the last issue of Detective Comics reviewing every file of every major villain with Jason Todd. You're completely overwhelmed. You know in the pit of your stomach you cannot win this and that it's done. You've been fighting this fight and it's done. So I'm making you this offer to come join me so we can change the world. And Batman doesn't show he's tempted in this scene, but the art does because his cape keeps creeping towards Roz. You know, and part of it seemed menacing, but part of it's also like, oh, is on some level he's considering this, which we'll see later in the story. But his physicality even changes. Like at certain points, Batman's body is built in a way that no body could work. It's distorted and twisted as he gets angrier and angrier. And it just is, I mean, it's pure Sienkiewicz. And you're right, I can't imagine anybody else conveying this with the same depth. And that the funny part is, it's the scene in the book I most remember. You know, when I think about Batman 400, even though I hadn't read it in years, when I picked it up again for this episode, this is the scene I remembered, you know, almost frame for frame, even though it's the least eventful or at least action-packed scene in the book. So getting Sienkiewicz for this was just phenomenal. And just real quick, thank God for a time before, you know, creators signed contracts. I mean, I'm all about creators signing contracts with specific companies because they get paid better, they get insurance. You know, that's all, that's great. But I loved when creators could pop back and forth between companies like this, because Sienkiewicz is right at his New Mutants run when this is happening. So him popping over and doing this little section for Batman, you know, probably wouldn't have happened today. So it's pretty cool that it happened, you know, that the artists were able to move as freely as they were back then, because this book is lost without this.
Yeah, that, I think that's why it's so special. You know, all these different artists today, you couldn't, you know, you wouldn't. You see they have anniversary issues, that sort of thing, or a special issue, and you got all the DC writers or artists. You have all the DC artists. You don't have, you know, crossover too much. The one thing I do want to mention about this particular chapter is the emotion that Batman has. The emotion that he can't control, and he just rips his desk and he throws it at the penny. And he throws it so hard, I don't know how heavy that penny is, but the penny actually falls over. And the art in it just, it's amazing. It's amazing. I know it can be an adjustment between once we go from Bill Sienkiewicz to, you know, Arthur Adams is more of a traditional style of Batman. And but still, Art Adams is incredible too.
Is Art Adams? Yeah, this is early Art Adams too, man. This is like, I think maybe even pre Long Shot or like just around Long Shot Art Adams. So, but the Sienkiewicz, I think you and I are both really centering on it because it is, you used the right word. It's emotional. It's evocative. Like it shows you again what could be just a scene of talking heads. It shows you the struggle Batman is having. And he even threatens, this is what's so cool. He's like, I can win this. And Roz is like, no, you can't. He's like, well, I could start with you right now. Like, I could take you out right now. And Roz is like, well, we both know you're not going to do that. And it's so cool because there's always been this interesting fear / respect with Roz and Bruce. And it's very present here. And it is basically Bruce throwing a tantrum. And the last, you know, one of the last things that Roz says to him is, oh, and, you know, kind of, by the way, happy anniversary. And that's what prompts him to chuck the desk at the penny. He's so angered by that. And you don't really understand why as you're reading it, or at least as a kid I didn't. And then you kind of get to the end and you understand what this anniversary is really, really means to him and how he's interpreting it differently than maybe some others. And this is just this chapter becomes the heart of the entire book. And that offer from Roz, you know, is really the heart of the book. And then, like you said, talk about a treat. You end Sienkiewicz, and you're like, well, who's the other great artist at the time who's doing things that are super experimental and will shape the industry for decades? And then, boom, there's Art Adams. it's an embarrassment of riches, man. It's like, I'm reading my floppy. It's almost a shame that it's printed on newsprint. Like, I haven't really gotten into digital comics yet. I'm just old, and I like feeling the comic in my hand.
Yeah.
I would get into it for this just to see the better version of the art of this because it's so beautiful.
Yeah, absolutely. And speaking about, you know, this anniversary, they kind of mention about this anniversary throughout the book. And there at the end, we actually get the party for this anniversary with, you know, Batman and his, I wouldn't say that they got Robin there, but then was it Commissioner Gordon and some of the others that were blindfolded and taken there?
Mm-hmm.
I thought Batman's reaction to that I couldn't think of any other reaction he would have. This is not a celebration. Him being Batman is not a celebration. There's nothing to celebrate. To me, I don't, maybe back in, you know, the Golden Age / Silver Age might be the time that you see, but you see the change from that Batman to this Batman that we have today.
Yeah, and I think it's really important because they are closing the door. I mean, this is the Bat version of whatever happened to the Man of Tomorrow, right? Like this is the capstone on the pre-crisis Batman, just like that story was for pre-crisis Superman. And I love the tack they take because, you know, there is, you know, prior to this moment, there is Batman the policeman's friend, you know, the kind of 1950s, 1960s Batman before Denny O'Neill and Neil Adams come on and make him a little bit grimmer and darker. And then, you know, Englehart and Rogers and all those great teams in the 70s, you know, extend that out. And he's definitely been a darker version of Batman under Munch and under Mandrake and Colin. And this book definitely, it does something really interesting where it's universal in that it's ending pre-crisis Batman. So all the villains are there, but it's very rooted in where the book is at the time. And I think that's most illustrated by who is actually not in the book. I mean, the fact that Dick Grayson isn't in this issue is pretty astounding, right? Like the villains, you know, Ra's in particular, going after the people Batman loves most, and that not including Barbara Gordon or Dick Grayson, you know, or Silver St. Cloud, or, you know, some of the stalwarts of his life, or in my, you know, opinion, Nocturna, who's his great love, though you disagree because you said she was one of his worst girlfriends. I think that's really interesting because they're keeping it rooted in where the book is, but they're also walking that line between pre-crisis. And like you said, by making him reject the anniversary and say, like, no, this isn't something to celebrate. In fact, this is a failure on my part because I'm still Batman and I shouldn't be Batman at this point. I think it walks an impossible line of honoring and acknowledging everything that came before, but also putting a exclamation mark on Munch's epic run. So that if you had been reading all along, and I had been reading the book for a while at this point, you still felt like you got a capstone to that run. And that's almost impossible to pull off. I mean, if you look at anniversary issues today, look at the DC anniversary issues, they're those 100-page, $10 giants. And they're like a collection of vignettes by creative teams over the years, but they don't continue storylines.
No, it's not like one continuous story. It's like separate stories.
Well, and they don't continue the storyline currently in the book usually. In fact, they're meant to be read autonomously and separately.
Right.
So I really appreciate them doing that. I like them walking the line. But I do want to ask you, like, what are your thoughts about Dick Grayson not being in this book?
Well, at this point, I'll be honest, it didn't occur to me that this wasn't the original Robin when I first read this.
Oh, okay.
But reading this again, the first thing I notice is you don't even have to tell me it's Jason Todd because he's a whiny little brat.
Oh, no, shots fired.
You know, but you can tell. You can tell that it's not Dick Grayson. I have no idea why this would have been, but do you know if Nightwing, you know, made that many appearances in the Bat book as Nightwing early on? Because I don't recall that happening a whole lot.
He doesn't. So there was an agreement at the time, and I've only, you know, obviously learned this later in interviews and stuff, but there was an agreement at the time that Dick Grayson was a Titans character, that he was Marv Wolfman's character.
I see.
To sort of control and dictate. And that's actually one of the reasons why Dick Grayson does not appear in the Bat books for a really long time. And then, you know, the first time he shows up as Nightwing, I think is either in a Teen Titans spotlight issue where Batman's kidnapped and Dick has to basically investigate and save him. So, you know, very Nightwing centric. Or it might be, I don't know how they coincide. That probably is first. But then there's Batman 416. Which is Nightwing and Jason Todd meeting for the first time. And Nightwing, you know, basically doing what Dick Grayson does, saying like, hey, kind of being an older brother, like, hey, I know how Bruce can get. If you ever need anything, give me a call. But Bruce and Dick don't see each other for quite a while. And that was kind of a little editorial thing where like Wolfman was like, look, I'm doing more work with Dick Grayson. He's the centerpiece of Titans. I'm going to give him his new identity, his new costume. I'm going to put him through the ringer emotionally. You know, that's why you have Jason. And so that's, I think that's one of the reasons why is there was a little bit of that going on. But even in the way they treat Jason Todd in this, it's funny that you call them a whiny little brat. Pre-crisis Jason Todd is basically just old, you know, it's Dick Grayson. It's the young Brobin from the like 50s and 60s hopping around, making bad jokes, you know, being a little bit of a pest.
Yeah.
It's not until after this when Jim Starlin comes aboard where we get like emo Jason Todd that I actually called in and voted to get killed, which I still feel okay about. But, you know, it's funny that you didn't realize it as a kid. That makes total sense. But they don't draw a lot of attention to it in this book, except for a couple moments, like when Killer Croc killed Jason's parents. So he has a visceral reaction to his name being mentioned.
Yes.
But for the most part, you could pretend it's Dick Grayson and be fine.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the only part that I really noticed is when he was tired of Batman trying to figure out know your foes, and he goes up to get something to eat.
Yeah, he's more interested in sandwiches than he is in you know, learning some facts that might save his life. But I think that you mentioned something really cool. The contrast between old and new in this book is really interesting. And for me, it's best encapsulated in the appearance of the Joker copter
in
chapter 6. Yeah, which is drawn by Tom Sutton. It was jarring. And I knew it was there. I remember them covering the police station. I remember that for some reason pretty viscerally. But I didn't remember that it was the freaking Joker copter with the Joker's giant face on the front of it. And I got to that point and I literally started laughing out loud because I was like, oh, this is really quaint because we're so far beyond this now. And maybe beyond is not the right word. Maybe we've lost something. But we're so far beyond this with the Joker that it's all, you know, the most recent appearance of Joker in a police station, he murdered all of them. You know, like he switched the lights off and killed them all like a scary horror movie. And so this is almost quaint and sweet because this is still, you know, dangerous Joker and hand buzzer Joker. But it's not, you know, Joaquin Phoenix or, you know, the Joker we're going to get coming up. I mean, what was your reaction? Especially because you review the Bat books every week and we're leading up to Joker War. What was your reaction to this Joker becoming, you know, being so present?
I thought it was interesting. I thought him in the copter, that was hilarious. I mean, you'd never imagine seeing the copter now. But the thing that I can relate to current comics as far as the Joker goes is everybody thinks Joker is one way. They just think he'll get in line and do what he's told, that sort of thing. But it never happens that way. You don't know what the Joker is. And it seems like you should know what the Joker is. For instance, you know, they want the Joker to, you know, encapsulate the Gotham City Police Department, and then they're going to, you know, have a ransom. Joker's not interested in a ransom. Joker does his own thing because Joker has his own reasons for doing things. Nobody else affects him. He only went along with this because it benefited him. And you can relate to that, to what's going on currently in the Batman comics, because the same thing. People have underestimated the Joker, and he just does his own thing, his own way.
Yeah, this reminded me a lot of the most recent issue of Batman with the designer, with that plot line, you know, getting wrapped up. That's probably what you were thinking too, where there's this new villain and, you know, he's got all the other villains sort of working for him in a way, and he's got Batman on the run. And then you find out this truth that the whole plan fell apart years ago. It was supposed to go through years ago when Batman was young, and it would have worked. Batman even acknowledges, yeah, it would have worked back then. But it fell apart because the designer could not get the Joker to do what he wanted him to do. And Batman even says, you know, you assume the Joker was just another serial killer. It's just another person you can manipulate, but Joker's a force of nature. Like, he's never going to do what anybody wants him to do.
Right. He's going to do his own thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And that moment when he, you know, when Penguin's like, the whole point of ransoming the police department was to get the $10 million. And Joker's like, ah, we don't need money. Money's easy. And he like poo-poos him. And Penguin's like, oh, I made a mistake. I partnered with the wrong dude, man. I should not have been on this team. I should have been on the team with Poison Ivy. It's pretty funny because Joker's just like, yeah, I'm not playing. This isn't the game. I went along with it because it's fun, but it's always been my game, which I love too.
Yeah. All the Gotham villains, you could probably ask, hey, what's your motivation as far as Batman goes? Oh, killing the bat. Joker doesn't have that motivation. And it's been around for a long time. He just wants to torture Batman. He wants to play this game. And he's always playing the game. That's the Joker that I like.
Yeah.
You know, there's been many versions of the Joker, and we're going to have this three Jokers here soon. And I don't know how that's going to play in different versions of the Joker, but I like this version. This is the Joker, this unpredictable version. You never know what he's going to do, that sort of thing.
Well, I love because it's that Grant Morrison explanation, right? That Joker is like a snake and just sheds his skin and reinvents himself. He's a blank slate. And he just kind of, however the world changes, he changes around it to like poke holes in it and to show it its own hypocrisy. So when the world was a little lighter and seemingly less dangerous, he was in a way. And then as the world changed, he changed. I love that view of him from that Morrison issue in the Morrison run. And I really like the idea that he is, this is going to be really controversial for people, but I think that the perfect encapsulation of what Joker's motivation is the Batman Who Laughs. Now, I'm not saying I love that character, and I am definitely on board with people who feel like he's overused. I also struggle reading his dialogue with red letters on black word balloons. But the actual Scott Snyder jock Batman Who Laughs mini is like freaking awesome, and you guys covered it. And it's really good. And I think it is actually, if you boiled Joker's motivation down, it's that he wants to be part of Batman. He wants to be together. Like there's, and I'm not saying that necessarily in any way that's sexual, but like he sees him as his other, and that the perfect thing is the merging of the two of them into one. And so in a weird way, Snyder hit on something with that. It's just in its execution, he's basically become, you know, so overused that he's going to become a symbol of this age of the worst qualities of this age of comics, even though there's been some really great storytelling with him. So I don't know. I like that there's a hint of that even back then. And I don't know. How do you feel about that? Are you on board with that? Or are you like, no, the Batman Who Laughs is awful?
No, I didn't mind the Batman Who Laughs at the beginning.
Yeah.
It's just too much Batman Who Laughs. If you had used him and, you know, in that mini, and then took a break from him, but we haven't had a break. We haven't had this time to, you know, it's sink into people as they're reading and be like, hey, you know, that Batman Laughs was kind of cool. I'd like to see him again. You never got to that point because he had been in everything throughout Justice League into every little crossover type of thing. He's been there, and I'm almost at the point I can't say that I could explain to anybody what Metal was about to a T. I mean, I had a good idea, and it seems like a good premise to me. The biggest problem is that he's already been the antagonist. You know, he's already been the big bad, and he's just been, how long has it been? It's been like 2 years? Has it been 2-3 years?
It feels like 10.
Yeah.
The number of appearances he's had. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, he's a cool character, but I think definitely being overused. Got Snyder has an interesting story coming up. It's just, I wish it wasn't all about, you know, these dark Batman, because we've seen this. It's not something new in the last few years.
Yeah, and I, you know, it's funny, if it had ended, if they had killed that character or taken him off the board after the Batman Who Laughs miniseries by Snyder and Jock, I would have been like, oh, cool, perfect. Like, this was perfect. They used him on a universal scale in Metal, which I agree with you, I couldn't tell you what it was about. And then they took it super personal in that mini, and they made him a really good antagonist for our Batman. And if they had just taken him off the board then, I would have really fond memories of that character. And I would be like, oh, I hope one day he shows up again. But yeah, the overuse of him is a bit much. And that actually kind of ties back to Joker for me, because Joker was the same way, you know, particularly after the Batman 89 movie, you know, and Death in the Family. And DC did something really smart at a certain point where they really restricted the use of that character so that when he showed up, it was special. And I wish they would go back to that for him as well. And, you know, and I'm reminded of why I like him even in Batman 400, because it's at a certain point, Munch is smart. Even though Ra's al Ghul is the main villain, he has a Batman and Joker on the rooftop scene, which you have to have.
Yes.
And Joker's got a gun at Batman, and he's like, I can just kill you right now. And Batman's like, yeah, why are you working for Ra's al Ghul? Like, since when have you been somebody else's pawn? And he kind of psychs Joker out, and he's like, why don't we team up? And Joker's like, okay. And he's like, you take me to where Ra's is, you know, and we'll get it all together. And Joker's like, okay, well, you know, Batman's like, tell me where Ra's is and we'll go together. And Joker's like, no, I'll take you, because otherwise you won't take me with you. And Batman goes, no, I promise. And this is so great. This is so pre-crisis. Joker goes, well, you're such a goody-goody that I know you'd never turn back on your word. So he's in this windmill and Batman knocks him out. And he's like, yeah, there's a first time for everything. I lied to you. And that for me is such a glimpse of post-crisis Batman, because Joker would never trust that post-crisis. So that's a fun moment for me. Like, what did you think about that interaction on the rooftop?
Yeah, you wouldn't have thought, yes, Batman, you know, over pre-crisis, you can see how, okay, Batman's a goody-two-shoes. He will never lie. He's always going to tell the truth. But here, you see that change, and it's sort of the change from pre-crisis to post-crisis. It's part of the change. This is a different Batman coming. A Batman that would lie to take out the Joker to get what he needs. I mean, he's still not going to cross that line where he's going to kill anybody, but what's a little white lie?
It's great, man. It's an awesome punch.
Yeah, that is a good scene. And I love, again, Rick Leonardi does the art in that, and the facial expressions there are pretty cool. And the inks on Batman's cowl when he's just about to take out the Joker is pretty cool.
Yeah, it's Carl Kiesel on inks, and so they're a good pair together. And yeah, it's a great scene, and I like that Munch gives us this moment, because it's a tip of the cap to say, like, hey, I made Ra's al Ghul the main villain, but let's not mince words. You know, Joker's really, I could have swapped him out, you know, like most people would associate Joker as Batman's main villain, you know, and then Ra's would be somewhere pretty close on the list. But, you know, it's I like that he gives that tip of the cap before we then get the very Ra's-centric final chapter. And it's drawn by Brian Bolland. And what are your thoughts? Yeah, what are your thoughts on it being drawn by Brian Bolland? Because it's one of, what, maybe three comics we've ever gotten that were actually drawn by him?
Oh, my gosh. Incredible. My favorite panel on maybe this whole book is Ra's coming out of the Lazarus pit.
Oh, I knew it. Yep, me too.
And his line coming out of the Lazarus pit, I am here, detective, and I have been reborn without dying.
It's one of the five greatest panels of Ra's al Ghul. Like, it's right up there with Neil Adams, you know, drawing him with a sword in hand in the desert. I mean, this is amazing.
Easily, yeah. And their confrontation is, Ra's thinks he's got the enhanced strength, and he said he really thinks that's all he needs to take out Batman, that just this 10 times the strength of a normal human, but Batman uses that to his advantage, you know, just by missing him. And, you know, he's like, Ra's is like on the attack with a bunch of an aggression, and Batman sort of just lets him get his aggression out. I know he punches a wall and hurts his hands, and then he does a, when he comes after him, he kind of ducks and flips him over into the Lazarus pit. It's just an awesome interaction, and the art and Ra's face in those panels are incredible.
And the flip, the way he draws that flip where Batman bends backwards and throws him over using his own momentum, it's visceral. I mean, I don't know what it is about Bolland's art. If it's the hyper-realism, or I don't know what it is, what separates him from other artists of a similar style? Because there are other artists who do this, right? Who do this sort of hyper-realistic style. Gene Ha, you know, is an example, maybe some others, but there's nothing like Bolland. And he's been a cover artist for most of his career. In fact, you know, if you stacked up his cover work versus his actual interior work, the covers, it's 1,000 to 1. You know, what do we have? Camelot 3000, Killing Joke, and this. And I mean, maybe some 2000 AD or something, but there's not much. And this is to get his work on here and to get it to be the final chapter is so special and is so worthy of an anniversary issue, especially when you think about that the heart of the book is Sienkiewicz, who's, you know, one of the great artists of the 20th century and 21st century. And then the capstone of the book is Bolland, who's one of the great artists. And we get so little work by him that it's even more special. And then the other pieces are punctuated by like Joe Kubert and George Perez. I mean, it's just a murderer's row. You know what it reminds me of? I don't know if you're a basketball fan. It reminds me of the Dream Team from 1992.
Oh, yeah.
Which, you know, it hit at this perfect time in history where Magic Johnson and Larry Bird were really past their primes. Like they were not the greatest players in the world, but they were close enough to their primes that they could still be on the team. And then you had Michael Jordan and Charles Barkley who were in their primes. And David Robinson, who was kind of, you know, entering his prime. I mean, it's just this murderer's row. And it was a time in history where you would never, ever get that kind of collection of talent and legends on the field again, or on the court again, I should say. And this reminds me of that, too. Like, to have Joe Kubert in a book with Bill Sienkiewicz and Brian Bolland and George Perez and John Byrne is just amazing. And I love that they have the audacity to give Bolland the final word, because, you know, normally Byrne would have, you know, gotten a little bit of a pissing match and wanted to do it, or, you know, they would have given it to short, you know, Perez or Kubert, and they're all obviously worthy, but Bolland, it's hard to imagine this scene drawn by anybody but him, because it just hits you right in the heart.
Speaking about Sienkiewicz and the cover here, how many covers where you have so many artists? And before I get into Sienkiewicz's, I just want to mention they have all the illustrators on the cover.
Mm-hmm.
I can't really remember a time where they had all the, but this book, the art makes this book. Yes, it's a good story, but the art makes this book. And it's really, to me personally, it's centered around Sienkiewicz's art. And we have that cover with Sienkiewicz, and it's incredible.
Yeah, the cover and the you know, cover, one of the things that makes it in particular is the coloring, because it's this deep, and I think it's Adrian Roy. Adrian Roy's the colorist for the interior, so probably for the exterior too. Yeah. And it is this deep blue, and it's this haunting image of Batman, you know, really wrestling with something. And you've got all these characters off to the side, you know, Batman or Catwoman, Robin, the Joker's face, you know, Ra's al Ghul. We don't realize it, but he's off to the side too.
Yeah.
It's just unparalleled as one of the great sort of abstract bat covers ever. And I, like you said, Sienkiewicz is the heart of this book. I mean, he's amazing, and it really is phenomenal. And it bookends really nicely with the final panel. Like, do you want to talk about that anniversary party, that final panel?
Yeah, let me just mention one thing more about this cover, and it's the image behind everybody of the bat.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually are using the bat wings as part of Batman's symbol. It's just incredible.
It's so cool. And, yeah. You know, and even though this isn't what they meant, but it is, you know, kind of, if you want to jump ahead, it's kind of that, you know, what is it, Barbatos, the, you know, sort of like.
Oh, yes, bat. Yes. It sort of reminds me a little bit about that.
Me too. I mean, I know, you know, Morrison and Milligan were probably influenced enough, you know, and they knew this issue. It may have played a role in it. But yeah, that reminds me of the way they did depict, you know, that Barbatos, you know, bat god kind of thing, which is really cool. Yeah, the anniversary party is interesting because he takes everybody back to the cave. And I do love that, you know, they've all been blindfolded and, you know, none of them, you know, are familiar with this. And they actually like all chime in like, happy anniversary, Batman. And, you know, if this were a different era, you know, Batman would have been like, thanks, chums, you know, but it's Munch, and Doug Munch loves his falling stalactites or stalagmites. And one falls into the cake like a candle. And Robin's like, an omen? And then, yeah, it's an omen. I mean, what are your thoughts on how they wrap this up?
I liked it. I liked that a lot, because I thought his reaction, especially when you see him there, you know, he has his cowl and his cape on, And then he has the bandages around his chest. And they're all yelling, "Happy anniversary!" And this stalagmite drops in the center of the cake. And he's like, "Yes, a single candle to mark the first night of a new beginning."
Mm-hmm.
And nothing, my friends, is to laugh about.
He's so grimdark, but I do love that Jason's like, "Ah, forget him, let's eat cake."
Yeah. Yeah, but it looks like it's all smashed, so he just grabs a handful. Like,
yeah. Oh, yeah, there's no decorum here. He's I'll eat around it. It's just rock. It's covered in bat guano, but I'll eat it. And the last panels are so great. Like, it's very purple prose. Like, it's you know, pretty intense, but it is the end of this Batman, and I love that he says, like, you know, indeed, with all the arch foes freed and so many still at large, still hunting the dark with their a maniacal evil, it is much like starting over. And that, I mean, that's like in bold.
Yeah.
And he says, and so the night of, sorry, my floppy's a little worn, says, and so the night of resurrection nears its end, but when next he strides forth from the dark womb of bats, it all begins anew. And he says, hello again, beware forever. And it's interesting because I think Munch is doing something really purposeful here where he knows it's all starting over in the next issue. He knows we're getting the, you know, whatever pre-crisis or post-crisis is going to look like. He knows it's going to somewhat potentially wipe away everything he's done, his entire run. And so I think there is a little undercurrent of the weariness that Batman feels in this issue of like, oh my God, I fight these guys again and I'm never going to win. And, you know, and then he gets the energy. He gets inspired by Talia, who we didn't even talk about. You know, Talia joins the fight.
Right.
And that kind of inspires him. He like, well, if you can go against your own father, I can do it too, and I can win the day. And he gets his momentum back. And then he kind of loses steam again at this anniversary party. Like, hey, this isn't a celebration. Like, me still being Batman means I failed. And so I think Munch is doing two things, which is really interesting. I think he's bringing this era to a close and acknowledging that Batman's been fighting the good fight. And the panel of the villains is cool because it's old villains like Two-Face, Mr. Freeze. New villain like Black Mask, you know, a Night Stalker. And so there's this kind of cross section of like, hey, look at all the work we did. Like, we took Batman, you know, for a good 40 something years. You know, we all worked together and built this character that's getting somewhat erased. But instead of giving in to the impulse of like, well, they're erasing my run, they're erasing everything I did, and being kind of petty about it, he has a sort of resignation about it that he has Batman feel. But he ends with like, okay, but the fight still goes on. And just because I'm ending doesn't mean somebody else was always going to come in and write Batman. And Batman was always going to fight the good fight again, no matter what. And so this is the permanence of this character. He can end and start again and end and start again a million times. And he's still Batman. And it's still the same, you know, truth. It's this little boy who wants to stop crime and end the threat of evil. And I like that a lot. What were your thoughts? Because I think it's a different way to end it than other writers would have taken.
No, I like the imagery in this, you know. I like Batman headed down the cave, almost like a tunnel, and either being followed by bats, or he's going, light is coming in through the tunnel, and he's headed toward the light. And the hello again, beware forever. He's beginning anew. I did like that. I did like the little panel there where you see the different villains. And speaking of the different villains that's been in this book, I just wanted to mention them real quick because there are a lot. So we have Black Spider, Catman, Cavalier, Dagger, Deadshot, Joker, Killer Croc, Killer Moth, Mad Hatter, Mirage, Penguin, Poison Ivy, Ra's al Ghul, Riddler, Scarecrow, Black Mask, Calendar Man, Captain Stingray, Clayface, Clue Master, Crazy Quilt, Dr. Double X, Dr. Phosphorus, Mirror Man, Mr. Freeze, Night Slayer, Signal Man, Tweedledee, Tweedledum, Two-Face. Did I miss anything?
No, and Ra's al Ghul.
Yeah, I did mention that.
Oh, you did? Sorry. Yeah. It's a smorgasbord of, and those are the ones that play a big role. You know, there's all those other ones who kind of leave early on too, and it's amazing, man. It's amazing how many villains they get in here. Who's your favorite?
A villain?
Yeah, not necessarily in this issue, but like of that list you read, who's your favorite?
It's hard. I do like this version of the Penguin a lot. I do like this version of Joker a lot.
Mm-hmm.
you know, some that weren't necessarily featured in here, like Mr. Freeze. You know, this is going to sound corny, but I really like the Signal Man and his appearances way back when. Now, I don't know with this version, and I don't think we've seen him too much or at all coming up, because he was so goofy and they kind of got away from some of the goofy characters. But yeah, what are some of your favorites?
You know, it's funny, you and I have a similar taste. I like some of the goofy, like I love, you know, Kite Man, hell yeah. Like I love Kite Man. But Catman's always been a favorite of mine because one of my first issues of Detective, or an early issue anyway, is Batman's fight with Catman. And even though he's completely derivative, I mean, he's just Catwoman as a man, I love his costume. And then I can't help but love him because of what Gail Simone does to him as a character, you know, in Secret Six. And so, and then Deadshot for me, this Marshall, I think it's Marshall Rogers' Deadshot costume, you know, with the silver mask and the red. I mean, that that is an all-time great costume. I love this villain. And then again, I love what's done with him in Suicide Squad. I mean, he becomes a major, major character for years. So those are two of my favorites. I do like when Deadshot and Batman fight, because I like the point where I think it's John Ostrander in Suicide Squad hits on the fact that Deadshot can never actually kill Batman. Like he actually has like a mental block against it, and Batman knows it and uses it at different times. So I think it's really cool. So those are two that I love, you know, and I love, you know, some of the sillier villains. I've actually never hooked into Penguin. My favorite version of Penguin is as like mobster, as you know, run of, you know, person who runs the Gotham Underground. I've never hooked into him as the umbrella wielding villain. And I think it's just because I didn't read a ton of pre-crisis stories with him. But those are my favorites. I'd say Catman and Deadshot definitely, you know, carry a lot for me. And a lot of it's based on their costumes at this point. But then later on, it's the work that's done with them by later writers.
Oh, absolutely. And the other one I wanted to mention was Black Mask. He just came into the books not too long ago. But I sort of have a problem with one panel with him in it. And do you know what panel that is?
Is it the one where he's saying Janice?
Yes. I have the problem because last time we saw him, his mask was fused to his face. And the description in there is his face now permanently masked by scars. Black Mask is one such. And you see his face, his mask that was fused isn't there anymore.
Yeah, there's a, I think there's a coloring issue maybe.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Because, yeah, that's what I was thinking. But it was like, okay. And that was me today, not me back when. Me today is like, oh, well, wasn't his last appearance basically his first appearance?
Yeah, you and I covered that.
Yeah.
We covered his origin on an earlier episode. And I love those issues. And you're right. That literally ends with him in a fire with the mask permanently burned onto his face. And so I think it's a coloring issue, especially because the way Lytle draws it.
Yeah.
His face is, even though like the cheekbones are so grossly pronounced that it's meant to look like a mask. So yeah, I think it was just that Adrian Roy maybe didn't realize it. Yeah. But yeah, no, I had the same moment. It's funny because you and I had covered those issues so recently, that character's been in my brain. And when I got to that point too, I was like, oh man, I was like, he should, you know, they screwed that up. And he's a great character.
Yes, absolutely. But I did like, and the other thing I want to mention, you know, this is going to probably be my first experience with actually seeing the Batman villains behind bars in Arkham. And you have that corridor in the one panel that you can see down and see all, you know, nameplates and that sort of thing, or you can imagine how they would be. But you see the Mad Hatter, for instance. Some you can tell are in, you know, Gotham Penitentiary, because they have the bars, and then some you can tell are in padded cells, like the Mad Hatter sort of thing. So I found that kind of interesting.
Well, and I like the dichotomy between it too. I like the line that's drawn between some of Batman's villains are truly insane, and then some of them are just criminals.
And
I like that. I don't need them all to be insane.
No.
I like some of them to be the Penguin, you know, to be just a mob boss.
Now, there was one line in here that I did have a question about, to see what your thoughts were. And Killer Croc, at one point, says, I want to break Batman's back. It's like a weird omen to what's coming in about 100 issues.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think they had any idea? Do you think that was thrown in just because it's Croc and, yeah, he could break his back? Or do you think that's like an omen for the future?
I think it's really cool. I think, you know, the Killer Croc, the pre-crisis Killer Croc is so different than post-crisis Killer Croc because he's basically a mob boss with a skin condition.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, yeah. And he's got some, you know, some form of super strength, but not like he does later. And, you know, he kills Jason's parents, which is part of Jason's origin. But I think it's really cool that the seed is planted that a super strong character, their version of breaking the bat is breaking his back. And so I think it's one of those cool moments that calls ahead. Like, you know, obviously they didn't know what was coming, but I think it is one of those things that it's the beauty of comics. It's the beauty of serialized literature of, you know, a story that's been told now for 80 years where you can see call aheads. And, you know, and I'm not saying that the authors of Nightfall necessarily looked back and saw that, but it is pretty cool. You know, I think it's awesome that you noticed it too. And I think, you know, if Bane isn't the villain who breaks the bat's back, it's perfectly fine if it's Killer Croc. I mean, you know, at the time, Killer Croc had more character development than Bane. I mean, Bane's gone on to become a better character, but it's really cool. Yeah, I like that too. I like that visceral nature of some of his villains versus the psychological nature of others. Like that scene is contrasted when Killer Croc, he's the one who goes and gets Alfred and he picks him up by the neck and like pins him against the wall. And it's so physically frightening. It reminds me of like Mr. Hyde and Jarvis in the Avengers Under Siege arc.
Oh yeah.
But then you contrast that with Julia Pennyworth coming home and thinking about taking a shower and opening it and the Scarecrow's just hanging in it and she passes out. Like it's such a cool little illustration of the different types of villains that Batman draws. You know, he's got the very physical, the very psychological. I mean, he's got the best rogues gallery in history, the history of comics. And this issue does a nice job of showing that some of them are brawlers and some of them are not.
Yeah, I like to see that. And I think they pick the certain villains intentionally so you could see different sides.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Crocs and the Scarecrows and Poison Ivy. You know, if you pick some of the lesser goofy villains, it might not have been portrayed exactly what they were trying to come across, you know, this changeover to a new beginning, that sort of thing. I think they picked the perfect villains here.
Well, I think they planted some seeds in later writers' minds because Poison Ivy was not a major villain at this point, right? Like she had actually not made a ton of appearances. And so having her be the one who captures Bullock, and then she's in a lot of scenes in this book, I think is also them planting some seeds for the people who would be not only considered major villains in the comics later, but most especially would be on Batman the Animated Series. You know, Paul Dini clearly read this comic, and it's pretty cool because, you know, he cherry picks a lot of the villains out of this and puts them in there, and then that catapults them to become bigger villains who appear in the comics. And, you know, it's a nice cycle. So I think this issue is so important. One, because it brings pre-crisis Batman to a close. And then two, the way they treated it, I think it's on par. I don't know if people consider it this. Look, whatever happened to the Man of Tomorrow is undeniably better storytelling. I mean, it's Alan Moore. You know, it's more sophisticated on some level maybe than this. You know, and I'm not disparaging Doug Munch. I love the straightforward nature of the story. But the art in this book and the use of the art and the meta-textual role the art is playing, for my mind, it puts it on par with it. Like, I don't, do you consider them equivalent or?
I would say. I mean, it's I don't think we have a panel that you can really complain about in this book.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? There's different artists that have different styles, but I don't think there's a panel in here that you can really complain about.
When the cherry on the sundae is that we get a series of pinups at the back.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's Bernie Wrightson, Mike Grell. I mean,
yes, Mike Grell.
It's the who's who of great artists.
Yeah, they're incredible, too. And that's something we got some in Batman 50 most recently, some pinups, but you don't seem to see those too often anymore. the Mike Grell, the cape on that is incredible.
Do you have a favorite of that series, of those pinups?
It's the Mike Grell, but it's hard to argue Bernie Wrightson.
Yeah, the Wrightson one for me. But you're right, Grell's right behind it. They're pretty amazing.
Yeah.
You know, the only artist who's missing, and it's just timing, they couldn't have known what was going to come in just, you know, like, what, 4 issues, I think?
Yeah.
The only artist they could have maybe nabbed for a bit would have been David Mazzucchelli. And it would have just been perfect because, you know, his Batman Year One is so definitive. That's the only, you know, or maybe Frank Miller. But it's, I mean, it's a perfect book. It's just it just is. It's a perfect comic book.
Oh, absolutely. So we'll try to wrap it up here. Did you have anything else you wanted to add about this issue?
No, just that, you know, if people who are listening have not read it, and, you know, it's an older issue. So, if, you know, Bill and I are old, but if you're younger and, you know, you haven't read it, it's so worth reading because it stands alone, too. You don't have to do a lot of, you know, big continuity dive or anything.
Nope.
Yeah,
not
you can
at
just
all.
Pick it up.
You pick it up and jump right into it. You don't need to know. You don't even need to know anything about any of these characters.
No, not at all. Just jump in, read it, and enjoy it for also as a snapshot of the amazing art happening at the time and the change in art happening at the time from the sort of more traditional, you know, Byrne and Perez, who are gods. I'm not disparaging their art, to the way more experimental, you know, Sienkiewicz, Bolland, you know, Art Adams. So yeah, I can't recommend this issue enough. I'm very thankful that you had me on today to talk about it because it's just one of my favorite comics ever. And like I said, it's kind of a holy grail for podcasting for me. I just didn't think I'd ever get a chance to talk about it.
No problem. No problem at all. But we're not done.
Uh-oh.
As you know, here on the Bat Pod, we have this little segment called Stump the Co-Host.
Oh, I thought I was going to get out of it. I thought I was going to get away from it.
I've just recently started to do it with guests that come on. Since Jay loves this so much, I thought it's so popular, everybody loves it, that I know you love it, and it's your turn, buddy.
Okay, I do love it. I just love hearing other people get subjected to it.
Well, yeah, for you on the guess, I have one question for you.
Okay.
So, welcome to Stump the Co-Host, and today we have Sean Ross, of course. And are you ready for the Stump the Co-Host?
Yeah, I'm as ready as I'll ever be.
And as always, there's cash and prizes, and you definitely want those cash and prizes.
Yeah, I won a book from you already once. I won the Batman cover book, so
yeah,
but that wasn't
Stump the Co-Host. We have no Batman cover books, no graphic novels. This is more than that. This is better than that.
All right, I'm ready.
So, you're ready. Today we discuss the book Batman number 400. And there was a ton of villains that appeared in Batman 400. I'm going to list 4 villains, and you're going to tell me the one villain that did not physically appear in this book. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Number 1, Poison Ivy. Number 2, Crazy Quilt. Number 3, Mirage. Or number 4, Film Freak.
Okay, so the first two I know are in the book. I know Poison Ivy's in there. Film Freak or Mirage. So Film Freak had appeared recently, and Julia even mentions him in a thought bubble. But I'm going to say I didn't. I think Mirage has that weird head helmet from what I remembered. I thought I saw it. So I'm going to go with Film Freak. I don't think Film Freak physically appears.
Okay. If you said Film Freak, you're correct.
Woohoo!
So yes, you got your question right. You won the cash and prizes. Would you like to know what you won?
I would like to know.
Well, you won. And this is really special since you're on this podcast today. It's really special. You should be really excited. You actually have won a tour of the Marvel Universe. Yes, you get to go to all the fantastic places in the Marvel Universe, experience things that you never experienced before. Unfortunately, your tour guide is the Beyonder from Secret Wars 2.
Oh.
So there's that.
Am I gonna have to teach him to go to the bathroom?
You might have to
bring
your leash with you.
Can I change my answer? Can I purposely miss the question? That's awesome, man. I was finally getting through a podcast without the name Beyonder coming up. This you spoiled it, man. This was perfect.
So leading into that, do you want to tell us about your podcast?
Yes, thank you. So I'm on the Pulp to Pixel podcast network and I am a co-host on a couple different shows. We have Marvel Secret Wars and Beyond, where Dr. G and I cover the every issue of every Marvel Superhero Secret Wars miniseries. We covered the beautiful gem that is Volume 1 that everybody loves. We covered the, you know, poop-covered lipstick that is Volume 2 featuring the Beyonder. And even though the issues are terrible, the shows are fun because they slowly drive us mad. And then we are currently covering Volume 3 by Jonathan Hickman and Iseb Ribic, which is the greatest Marvel crossover of all time. Greg Arugino and I also co-host the Never Ending Reading Pile, which is a show where we pick one issue or very short arc from characters or comics we love and then talk about them and use them as jumping off points to talk about the character as a whole. And that show is a lot of fun because we get to jump companies and universes and times and just cover everything we love. So yeah, so I would love for people to come over to Pulp to Pixel to check out our shows and just to, you know, hear what we're doing.
Absolutely. I highly recommend. And speaking of that, I just had read Flash number 1.
Oh.
Like a week ago, you know, the Wally West Flash number 1, and then I see that you're covering that in a new episode.
Yeah, that's perfect timing. Our most recent episode just dropped yesterday, dropped on July 4th. And it covers the Wally West, the early years of the Wally West Flash run. We used issue 19 as our jumping off point, but we actually talk about that whole William Messner Loebs and Mike Baron era. So that's awesome. I'm glad. Have you read that before?
Oh, yes, I have. Oh. The first, I don't know, 100 issues of so of the Flash run.
Yeah, that's a great book.
Yep, absolutely. So, okay, well, thanks again for being on the show. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, man. Again, this is awesome. I always love recording with you. I have a lot of fun. You've been kind enough to have me on the show a few times. And so I listen to the show religiously. And so what invariably happens is I'll listen to like a few episodes in a row and I'll be like, I want to talk to Bill. And I'll just reach out and I'll completely invite myself on the show. So if that ever gets old, feel free to let me know.
It's all good. All good. Anytime, man. Anytime. So let's go ahead and get out of here. If you'd like to leave feedback for the Batpod, our email is batpodpodcast@gmail.com. On Twitter, we are @bat_pod. We have a Facebook page, facebook.com/thebatpod. If you listen to us on Apple Podcasts, please consider giving us a review. We'd really appreciate it. A big thank you to everybody that has retweeted our show on Twitter and Facebook. Until next time. Same bat time, same bat channel. We will see you later.